Thanks everyone for coming out tonight. I'll start with a real quick story about people getting inspired to hike. In 1992, I was in the US Army. I was stationed at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, DC, and I was working in cardiology. At that same time, there was a man named Scott Williamson, who was my same age, and he was working as a clerk at a convenience store in Truckee, California. The story is a guy came in and wearing a hoodie and asked Scott what time it was, and he looked at his watch, and when he looked up, the guy had pulled a pistol out and shot him in the face. Shot him right through the left side of his cheek. And Scott stumbled backward and then bolted for the door and burst through a locked door. Well, the guy gave chase and fired five more shots at him. Chased him out in the parking lot and fired five more shots at him, none of which hit. Scott Williamson had an epiphany, as he describes it, that you ought to be doing what you want to be doing. He had hiked the Pacific Crest Trail or portions of it before, and he decided, you know, life is fragile and precious, and you ought to be doing what you want to be doing. So he went out and started hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. Since then, he's hiked it up and down 13, 14 times. He holds the southbound speed record. He was the first to yo-yo the entire trail, that is, hike from Mexico to Canada and back all in one season. It's like 5,200 miles. He's an amazing hiker, and I've never met him, but reportedly a very nice guy. And I just want to say, I had the same kind of epiphany. It took me a lot longer. It took me 18 years of working in cardiology and seeing patient after patient come through our cardiac cath lab, people who thought they had more time, thought that someday they were going to be able to do this great thing, or you know, had plans for the future, but instead were suffering from heart attacks and vascular disease and getting limbs amputated. And after a while, I thought, you know, is this my future? Am I going to wind up just coming through here as a patient? And I'll tell you too, my own mother passed away from heart disease, and I was kind of in a tailspin. It was 2010, and I decided, I'm going to go hike the Appalachian Trail. And I'll tell you too, I mentioned to my brother, he was kind of the first person I told. I said, well, what do you think people will say if I tell them I want to through hike the Appalachian Trail? And he said, people won't know what you're talking about. I said, everyone knows the Appalachian Trail. He said, no, they don't. And he was right. A lot of the people that I said, I'm going to go hike this trail, goes from Georgia to Maine. Maine, the state. Few people knew about it. And I admit, I didn't know that much about it when I first came up with the idea. But I started doing some reading and learning about it. And eventually, I got through it. If I'm going to talk about hiking, I'll mention a couple things that Sarah already said. Just so you know, I'm for real. I thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail in 2011. I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail in 2012. The Shore to Shore Trail, which runs across the northern lower peninsula from like Empire across to Oscoda. I did that right after the Pacific Crest Trail. I was the first to thru-hike what I called the Ironwood Trail, has now been called the Iron Bell Trail, in 2013, as well as the Great Lake to Lake Trail. And then just last October, I finished the Continental Divide Trail. That's me, starting on the Appalachian Trail. Rookie as much as anyone else. My backpack was way too big. I caught a flight down to Atlanta, and I got a ride to Springer Mountain in Georgia. It's a little blurry, but that's where it starts there. And the Appalachian Trail is unique for a couple reasons. One is the entire trail is blazed with these 2-inch by 6-inch white marks. They're on trees and rocks and signs the whole way along. It's 2,170 miles, and the whole thing is blazed up and down. You could pretty much do it without a map. I did it with just a guidebook anyways. And this is the very first blaze. This is at Springer Mountain in Georgia. I think that sign reads like Tennessee-Georgia border. And I was still pretty new on the trail. The backpack was still too big. But it was at this point where I started having this epiphany, like, I love this. This is what I want to do all the time. I don't ever want to go back to Michigan or living in the towns. I just want to hike all the time. I need to figure out a way to make this work. I was what they call ruined. And so since then, I've been lucky enough to figure it out. Again, the Appalachian Trail is really well-worn. I mean, upwards of 1,000 people go out there and try and thru-hike it every year. So it's well-trod and well-blazed. And it's the whole trail has these little kind of huts. They call them shelters along the whole way. About every 8, 10, 12 miles, there's a little shelter like this. And it's just kind of a three-sided building. And it has like a platform where you can put your sleeping bag in your pack. And it's nice. Get you out of the weather. You know, hikers gather here. There's a lot of camaraderie. You can get the latest trail information. Sometimes it gets pretty crowded, I'll tell you that, on a cold, rainy night. They'll try and fit 15 people in there, and it's, you know, it's crowded. Everyone's moving around and snoring. And here's another one of the shelters. This one has a little ledge here that has the shelter journal, you know, just a notebook for hikers to write notes to each other, and a picnic table and a nice fire pit. That's my friend Kathy there. This is my gear spread out. I must have hit this shelter early in the day because I had had it all to myself, at least for a while. I had my sleeping bag all set out and my pack set up. Later, you hang your food on a mouse line. One disadvantage of shelters is lots of rodents. Because so many people stay there and they eat and prepare food in there, you get lots of rats and mice, and they can dig into your pack. So that part of it's not so much fun. And I'll admit to you, I kind of got sick of you know, the crowds and being around people that much. So eventually, I started just camping. You know, maybe I would stop at a shelter and say hi to my friends and get some water, and then I would camp, you know, another mile or two up the trail, hopefully near a nice little brook like this, get a nice private spot. This was ideal. I fell in love with not just the hiking, but the hiking lifestyle, and I discovered this whole subculture of long-distance hikers. They had their own language and their own heroes, and they're just the way they related to each other. They were so generous and such kind people. And you meet lots of friends. This was a father and daughter that I hiked with, I think for about 3 weeks or so on the Appalachian Trail. We all hiked about the same speed, and they were more experienced than I was, so I was learning a lot from them as I went along. And some of these friendships have lasted. I'm still in touch with these two. Once you get your trail legs under you, and you get a little bit faster, and you learn what kind of gear you need, and sometimes more importantly don't need, and your pack gets a little bit lighter, you start summoning the mountains along the trail, and you know, I drop some pounds and start feeling really good. And again, I fell in love with the lifestyle. Lots of wildlife the whole way. People say, "Oh, did you see any wildlife?" Well, of course, you're out of doors 24/7 for months at a time. So, snakes and bears and raccoons and skunks and mice and everything you can imagine, you see out there. This was a rattlesnake that was on the Appalachian Trail, but it was a chilly. It was late in the year. It was probably late September, and it was cold, and he wasn't much of a threat. He was pretty slow. Beautiful scenery on the Appalachian Trail. This is outside of Damascus. My friend that I met, Gardner, she's also from here in Michigan, brought a penny whistle with her. Another thing I learned about these long-distance trails is every year that you go out, or every big trail that you try, there's some huge hurdle, something that happens that makes you think that you're not going to be able to finish the trail. For instance, when I was doing the Appalachian Trail, Hurricane Irene hit the East Coast, and they closed huge sections of the Green Mountains and the White Mountains. And I thought, how do you close a national forest? You know, it's a big chunk of woods. Well, you put signs like this everywhere, and you threaten to fine anyone in there for a $5,000 fine if you get caught in the forest. So I thought my hike was over. A lot of it's kind of clumped up outside in Hanover, New Hampshire. But eventually, people started getting through, and we realized it was navigable, and we were able to keep on going. But I'll mention some more examples coming up of these huge things that happen every year that make you think your through hike is over. One of the great things about hiking is little side trips that you can take along the way. For example, the Appalachian Trail goes near Stowe, Vermont, home of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, and I got to tour the plant there. And that's the kind of thing you can either do a lot of if you have the time and the resources, lots of little side trips, or you know, you can just stick to the trail and keep on going. But I definitely didn't want to miss Ben & Jerry's. I changed my attitude about a lot of things when I was out there. I'm from here in Michigan, born and raised, and wasn't much into the environment or conservation or ecology, but living out of doors, again, 24/7 will make you appreciate nature and change your mind about a lot of things. I spent some time doing work for stay, meaning this guy runs this organic farm. This is in Massachusetts, and he lets hikers camp on his farm. And he feeds you three great meals every day in exchange for working, whatever he tells you to do, just farm work. And it was a great experience. Again, it was a little side trip that I took from the trail. I learned a lot about organic farming and met some other really cool people, and it was just a great experience. If all goes well and you hike the entire 2,170 miles, you wind up at Mount Katahdin, which is in remote north central Maine. And this is sort of the obligatory picture that everyone takes when you get to there. It's the northern terminus of the Appalachian Trail. I mentioned some of the terminology. This was spaced out differently, but these hikers, these long-distance hikers, have their own language. For example, day hikers, section hikers, and through hikers. And the differences between them, day hikers, first of all, they stink like soap. You can spot them a mile away. They wear cotton, they have their collars popped, and they're jauntily, they have a sweater casually thrown around their neck. And there's nothing wrong with that. They're out for the day, they're having a hike. Section hikers are smart people. They do entire trails, entire Appalachian Trail, entire Pacific Trail. They just do it a few hundred miles at a time. And they go home, they make sure they have the right equipment, they constantly reevaluate. They go and do certain parts of the trail at the best time of year when the weather's the best. They have jobs. They're smart people. Then there's nasty, stinky through hikers like me who become convinced that they have to do the entire trail all in one season, and it's almost always a race against the weather. And you can smell us from a mile away, too. But we're a different crowd altogether. Zeros, Neros, and Dirty 30s are all terms that refer to mileage. A zero is a zero-mile day. It's taking a day off the trail. You have to take a day, you know, every like 7 to 10 days to rest and to resupply. If you just try to keep going constantly, you know, you risk injury. You need a day off once in a while to do your hiker chores, you know, to do some laundry, get your resupply. Maybe you go to the post office and get stuff from home, fresh maps and food and more fuel. You know, you catch up on the social media, all those sort of things. Zeros are necessary and fun. Nero is nearly 0 miles hiked, and that's more what I do these days. I tend to hike right up to the edge of a town and camp, and then early the next morning go into town, do all my hiker chores, and try and get out of there that afternoon or that evening, and at least get a few more miles on the trail. That way you save the money of a hotel room and that sort of thing. And dirty 30s are the other end of the extreme. That's like 30 miles in a day. As in, you know, oh, I had to do a dirty 30 to get to my next resupply point. Yellow blazing, the concepts of yellow blazing and purity, things like that. So when you decide you're going to through hike a long distance trail, you kind of have to decide how pure you're going to be. Are you going to stick just to the trail and hike every square inch of it? Some people are very focused on that. Some people, it's no big deal if they miss a part or they skip a little bit or they take a ride, you know, around this part. It's all about purity, and it all has to do with this last term, the most important one, hike your own hike. As long as you're having fun, who cares what anyone else says? You know, you'll see people who are pure and they're doing every inch of it, and then you'll see people who, you know, the weather was bad one area, so they skipped it. And I say, as long as you're out there and having fun. I want to talk real quick about trail angels and trail magic. Two of the most beautiful things about long distance hiking. Trail magic refers to anything positive, anything good that you come across along the trail. There are points along all the major trails, especially near road crossings and stuff, where people will put out a cooler full of water and soda and ice and a sign that just says, hikers, help yourself. And you come across stuff like that, and it's like, wow, you know. I'll never be able to thank them for doing this. They're just doing it. They're just kind for the sake of being kind. And it's sorely missed in today's world. And when you come across like stuff like that, it really feels good. You know, for me, gratitude is a very powerful emotion. And when I come across trail magic, I really appreciate it. And trail magic is generally left out by trail angels. Trail angels are anyone who helps a hiker. It could just be help with directions, or a bottle of water, or a piece of fruit. Some trail angels will go way to the extreme, invite you into their home, get a shower, get a good night's sleep, let me make you dinner. They just like to be around hikers. They just like swapping stories. And I've met some of the nicest people in the world doing these long distance trails, people who went, you know, far and above. And I feel like saying, you just met me and you're, you know, inviting me into your home, and they're fine. They're angels. Some of the heroes of the long distance hiking world. Earl Schaefer, first of all, he was the very first person to through hike the Appalachian Trail. He did this in 1948, just after World War II, with old, you know, army surplus gear, a big canvas tent, and he was the first one to hike from Georgia up to Maine. They called it the Government Trail back in those days, and he was an amazing guy. He wrote a book called Walking with Spring, and he was very amicable. He wrote poetry, and he wrote music about hiking. He was really an ambassador for the Appalachian Trail for a lot of years after that. He passed away just a few years ago. Scott Williamson, again, was a Pacific Crest Trail record holder, used to be for northbound and southbound and the first yo-yo. Just last year, a young hiker, Heather Anish Anderson, beat his northbound record. That's a 2,600-mile trail, and she did it in 62 days, I think, averaging like 44 miles a day. I mean, I've never hiked that far. And when I did that trail, it took me 5 months and 25 days. So for her to do it in just over 2 months is really impressive. Andrew Skirka is not human. He's a cyborg from the planet Hikes a Lot. And he's been sent here to teach us how to through hike. He is an amazing innovator in lightweight gear. He's wrote a couple different books. This is a guy who was inventing his own trails. He did he called it the Great Western Loop. He did the Pacific Crest Trail, the Arizona Trail, and the Continental Divide Trail, all of them in one season. Wow. He invented a trail he calls the Sea to Sea. He went from the Atlantic across to the Pacific. He's also a Triple Crowner. He's an amazing guy. He's also sponsored by National Geographic and a lot of the big gear companies. He's an amazing guy, but the long distance hiking community is small enough that he'll still take your call. You can email him and ask him questions. I've got a first edition of one of his books up there. You're welcome to check out afterward. Ray Jardine is the father of ultralight hiking. He was the first one in the early 90s to say, we need lighter gear, lighter materials. I'll tell you this, it's all about the weight when you're out there. Light is fast, and fast is fun. When I first started out, like a lot of people, I had too much gear. My pack was too heavy. And you risk injury, it's hard to make the miles. And once you become more comfortable with your gear and learning about the things that you do and don't need, you get lighter and lighter and lighter, and it becomes more and more fun. Now, there are guys who take it to the crazy extreme. I mean, they don't carry a tent. They just carry a poncho that basically they guide out as a shelter at night. They don't carry anything superfluous. They don't carry any extra gear. They cut the straps off their backpack. They cut the handle off their toothbrush. Anything that they don't need, they ditch it. And they are ultra light. And it's a thing with them. Some of us call them gram weenies because they measure everything in grams and how many grams you're carrying. But they also do the miles. I'm not ultra light. I am evolving toward it. You know, it's an interesting thing because you can't just read a book and say, I'm ultra light. You can't just go out there and do it. It takes a combination of research and learning and experience with your gear and on the trails to be able to do it. Nimblefoot Will Nomad has hiked all 11 National Scenic Trails. He's out there every year. He's one of the guys that people who are really into it come across once in a while. He's short in stature. I think he's like 70 years old, big white beard, but really amazing guy. And you know, anyone who's done all 11 National Scenic Trails, I want to talk to him. Billy Goat is out on the Pacific Crest Trail every year. He just does that one trail up and down every year, and people who have hiked that trail almost inevitably have run into him. Eric Rybak is from Michigan and credited with the first to thru-hike the Pacific Crest Trail. Some also say the Continental Divide Trail. I'm not sure he was the first, but certainly one of the early ones to do it. Back in 1977, he was doing these trails. He wrote a book called The High Adventures of Eric Rybak, and he is the first person that the American Long Distance Hiking Association went to him and said, can we please award you the Triple Crown? We have this award for people who have done the Appalachian Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail, and the Continental Divide Trail. And you don't need to apply for it. We'd like to award you. He's an amazing guy and a great ambassador for long-distance hiking. This is the Triple Crown I was talking about. The Appalachian Trail, it's about 2,200 miles from Georgia up to Maine. And then kind of a natural progression, or the progression I took was the Pacific Crest Trail goes from Campo, California, right on the border with Mexico, all the way up to Manning Park, just across the border with Canada. And it's 2,600 miles. It's amazing and beautiful. But neither one of them are as long or as difficult as the Continental Divide Trail. That goes from Mexico up into Canada. It's 3,100 miles, and it's the big daddy of all the trails. I finished the Appalachian Trail and right away started scheming and dreaming about the Pacific Crest Trail. I really wanted to try this. I knew that if I could get to Campo, California in April sometime, by that point I had learned enough about hiking and my gear had evolved enough so that I thought I could give it a shot. The Pacific Crest Trail is pretty well blazed the whole way. It's not complete. There's certainly big sections where you have to just go kind of cross country, but a lot of maps and compass, but at least there's blazes along the whole way. This is me at the border with Mexico. That wall behind there is just corrugated aluminum. That's the border. And there's this statue that just says that this is the southern terminus of the Pacific Crest Trail. One of the cool things about the Pacific Crest Trail is about just a couple days into it, there's a huge gathering at Moreno State Park, which again is right near the beginning of the trail, and they call it the kickoff. And thousands of hikers gather here, and it's a lot of fun. They have tons of classes and lectures about desert hiking and alpine hiking and gear. They teach you the things you need to know to be able to do a trail like this. This is a shot of all the vendors show up and show off all the latest ultralight gear and everything. And it was a very positive experience for me. I went there and I learned so much, and I met people that, again, I'm still friends with today. This is near Mojave, California, I think. You can see the wind turbines in the background. The southern part of the Pacific Crest Trail just goes through desert. It's the Mojave and the Anza Borrego Desert, and they are difficult. The water is 20, 25 miles apart. You need to learn how to manage, you know, your water. I'd love to carry 20 gallons of water, but it's too heavy. And so you need to start learning, well, what's the most water I can carry and still make it to the next water point? Like, for me, I know that I need about a liter of water for every 5 miles that I do. So I carry for a maximum of 5 liters. Any more than that, and it's too heavy, I can't make it to the next part. After you finish the desert, you go up into the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and they are just spectacular. Some of the best hiking in the whole country. I took this picture because my hiking buddies were up ahead, and because this was the first snow that I saw, and it does this weird thing called sun cupping. It makes these little sort of towers. It's really difficult to hike on, but I was really lucky. The year I did the Pacific Crest Trail was very dry. There was hardly any snow, and it's a gamble. You know, every year that you go out there, you plan and you save and you work so hard just to get to the start of the trail, and the weather that year could be anything. Could be tons of snow, could be a nice dry year, or anything in between. This is me on top of the highest point in the lower 48 states. This is Mount Whitney at 14,508 feet. Some more random shots from along the Pacific Crest Trail. That's Mount Rainier. And this was one of my favorite camping spots. I just, you know, unlike the Appalachian Trail where they have those shelters along the way, the Pacific Crest Trail is just camp where you want, just the whole way. There's very few established campgrounds. You just find a nice rocky precipice that has a beautiful view and set up your tent. Crater Lake National Park in Oregon. A lot of the trail, the Pacific Crest Trail, is like this. Just, you know, pretty well trod. You know, a foot across maybe. That's my buddy Hee-Haw up there, and I think we're headed toward Mount Rainier at that point. This is the Knife Edge in the Goat Rocks Wilderness. The trail follows. It's hard to see here, but it follows this Knife Edge all along here. That little speck is my buddy Astro. I'll mention him real quick. Amazing young man, 24 years old, diagnosed with cancer, goes through the bone marrow transplant and the chemo and the radiation and the whole thing, and the cancer persists. His doctors recommend another round of chemo, and he says, no, thank you. I'm going to go hike the Pacific Crest Trail. And I wound up hiking with this kid, and for as young as he was, I learned a lot from him, just all that he had been through. And if you pick up this month's issue, I got a copy up there of Backpacker Magazine. They did a really good story on him and quoted me and some other hikers who got a chance to hike with this guy about our experience with him. Really amazing person. He passed away, I'm sorry to say, about 10 months after finishing the trail, but he hiked the whole trail. The year I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, 2014, I didn't know that the whole state of California catches on fire every year. But that was the big hurdle that year, these huge fires, and they were closing huge sections of the trail. This was, I think, the Three Sisters Wilderness, and right after I passed through, I started hearing from other hikers that there was a big fire and the trail was closed, and I had just made it through, but these billowing clouds coming up. And unlike, you know, after a hurricane goes through, yeah, you know, there's a lot of downed trees and the water may be really high, but you can make it through. After a fire, you can't. So there was a lot of hiking around the burned out areas, taking alternate trails, road walking, whatever you need to do to keep on going. If everything goes well, you will wind up at Manning Park in Canada. That's me, that's Astro, who passed away, and our buddy Gourmet. And I tell you, I finished this hike by the skin of my teeth. It was late in the year. It was late October. I hiked as fast as I could, but it just takes a long time. It's 2,600 miles. And the snow was, ankle deep already, and I didn't have the right equipment for that. And I really, really just finished just in the nick of time. The guy who tried to finish after me wound up getting lost. He was out there for 9 days. Search and rescue had to come and get him. It was a really bad scenario, and could have been me. You know, when the snow is like that, the trail just becomes obscured. It's really hard to follow. It was a difficult situation. But I came home, and I still wanted to hike. And I felt like the winter or the cold conditions had kind of chased me off that trail. So this was November of 2014. I wanted to do the Shore to Shore Trail. I found out about this trail from my friends at Moose Jaw, And as I mentioned, it starts in Empire and goes across to Escoda. It's a horse trail. It's managed by the Michigan Trail Riders Association. But what a sweet piece. It took me 2 weeks to go across. I set up resupply boxes in Kalkaska, and I can't remember the other little city, but I basically just went to a gas station with my box full of food and fuel and all the stuff I would need. And I said, can I leave this here for about a week? I'll be back, and I'll be stinking, and I'll be hungry, and I'm going to want this box. And they said, sure. So I set up my own resupply, and it was a really fantastic trail. When I got back from that, a friend of mine called, and she said, did you hear that the governor just proposed this brand new trail? He's all hot on Michigan becoming the next trail state. And he told the DNR to come up with a trail that goes from Belle Isle all the way up and across the UP to Ironwood. And he just proposed it. If you hike it, you'll be the first, which is a very attractive proposition to a long-distance hiker. I said, the first? I don't think I've been the first to do anything in my life. This will be great. So using this, basically, as a map is all I had, I set out from Belle Isle on late April in 2013. And started hiking north, right up through the city, right up through Detroit. I hiked along Jefferson, and then I went up in front of the Mac Avenue plant with my backpack and my trekking poles, and I got some weird looks. But it was fun. It was great. I call myself an urban hiker at that point. I camped along the way wherever I could find a spot, for example, along the Pier Road, just because there's just, you know, there weren't defined camping spots all the way. We call this stealth camping or guerrilla camping. It's a skill that I actually picked up doing motorcycle touring with my brothers. If you found yourself without a campground or a hotel or whatever, you maybe just take the little corner of a farmer's field and set up your tent and get out of there first thing in the morning. There's a couple rules. Number one, you leave no trace. You don't do a campfire and loud stereos. You just set up your tent, you sleep, and you get up in the morning and go. Number two, if anyone tells you to leave or asks you to leave or whatever, you just leave. You don't argue. You're, you know, trespassing in most instances. But if you do it right, you know, you go in after dark, set up your tent, crash out, leave early in the morning or at the crack of dawn, you can get away with it. And I do an awful lot of stealth camping these days. This was, again, the Ironwood Trail. This was up along Lake Huron, I think, like Charlevoix area. It was a tough trail, especially the middle part of the Upper Peninsula. You know, I had to go like from the bridge straight through the center of the UP, and I finally came out on the southern shore of Lake Superior. And I tell you, it's weird to say it now, but I was so glad to see that lake that I wept. I just fell down on my knees and started crying. I was getting chewed by bugs. I'd been wearing my bug spray for, you know, like 2 weeks straight. It was super hot and just muggy and just difficult. And I came out on the, you know, the source of 10% of the world's fresh water, and the trail just followed the beach along for all the way through Pictured Rocks. It was some fantastic hiking. And the rest of the Upper Peninsula was great. This trail that the governor came up with across the UP, it follows the North Country Trail, which is actually a much bigger trail that goes from North Dakota all the way across to New York. It's 4,600 miles long. Only about six people in the world have thru-hiked it all in one season. But I got to do at least the Michigan portion of it, and it was fantastic. Some of it runs along old railroad beds and rails-to-trails type conversions. When I was coming across, there had been a huge fire up there just the year before, and the whole forest was burnt out. It was eerie and beautiful at the same time. And I was so thankful that people from the North Country Trail had come out and reblazed it so I could find my way through there. Again, bugs were horrible. You know, this is Michigan's UP in, you know, late June and July. It's biting flies of all sort. And I knew it was going to be bad, but boy, it just really changed my hike. The North Country Trail is blazed with a blue blaze. They use a 2-inch by 6-inch blue blaze. And there's places like this super nice boardwalk along here. The people up there, the whole trail is managed by a series of clubs. And they love their trail. And they work very hard to maintain it and take care of it. And I appreciate it. And when I get to meet people from the North Country Trail, it's my pleasure to thank them in person. This was back down south. This is the Midland to Mackinac Trail. Is a 230-mile stretch of... Well, I should tell you, too, since they have named the trail the Iron Bell Trail, and since the governor signed off on it, they've modified it quite a bit from I hiked it. The version I did was 924 miles. Now they have a bike portion and a footpath portion, and I think the footpath portion is substantially shorter, but when I did it... a big hunk of it was the Midland to Mackinac Trail, which was a sweet piece. This is, again, the southern shore of Lake Superior. No one around for miles and miles, just that beautiful sugar sand. Set up your tent, sleep like a rock every night. Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore. I had seen pictures ever since I was a little kid, heard all kinds of people talking about it. There's nowhere else like this in the country. It is stunningly beautiful, and if you get a chance, you should go and visit it. It's a gem. It's of Michigan's. It's a treasure. If all goes well, you wind up in Ironwood, and by the time I got to Ironwood, I had done like some newspaper interviews and some radio interviews and stuff like that. There was some hype about the trail, and when I got to Ironwood, they gave me a welcome that was over the top, embarrassing. They met me on the edge of town. The mayor came out, the city council, business leaders, they had a police escort. We came into town, they had banners and hotel signs. Welcome, long-distance hiker Chris Hillier. It was, embarrassing a little bit because I kept saying, you realize it's just walking. You guys get that, right? And also, at the same time I was doing this, Heather Anish Anderson had just done her record-breaking northbound hike of the Pacific Crest Trail, which really is an accomplishment. And here I was getting all this notoriety and giving speeches and free dinners and hotels. It was a lot of fun. Ironwood turned out to be one of my favorite cities, and they have been lobbying the government a lot to be part of the trail. They welcome business. They want people to come up there and hike and ride their bikes and even their snow machines, because when they go there, they get a hotel room, they spend money, and they add to the economy. But the whole time I was doing that trail, I was scheming to do the Continental Divide Trail. Now, I was intimidated, I'll tell you, from the start, I was intimidated about this trail. Number one, it was way longer. It's 3,100 miles. Better hikers than I had gone out there and come home and been turned away. They said it's not complete. You have to have excellent map and compass skills. The water is super far apart. It's just a tough, tough trail. But I wanted to try. I wanted to go for it. So in April of last year, I set out. In Palomas, Mexico, some friends and I started with two other guys, and we wanted to start in Mexico and hike into Canada. So we went across the border down to Palomas. This is their statue of Pancho Villa. And we had a margarita and started hiking. And I did this trail differently from the start. I did trail shoes instead of hiking boots. I had a backpack that was custom made for me by a company called Honor Point. They wanted to get into the long-distance hiking market, and so they built me a backpack to my specifications, which was fantastic. And I was as ultralight as I could be, and I needed to be, because the first part of this trail was super difficult. I did tons of cowboy camping on this trail. I had a really good tent, but every night that I could, I would just sleep out under the stars. And not only is it beautiful and relaxing, but you can get an earlier start in the morning if you don't have to set your tent up again. And the scenery was just amazing. This is Cirque of the Towers. This is in Wyoming. It's pretty remote, but it's like nothing I've ever seen before. You're surrounded by these 13,000-foot peaks. It's just beautiful. And you can only get there on foot. Lots of road walking on this trail. Hiked up through New Mexico, went pretty well. At least one guy and I stayed together the whole way. By the time we hit the border with Colorado, huge snow had fallen in the South San Juan Mountains, and hikers were trying to figure out a way to get around it or, skip up and down the trail, go up to Wyoming and Montana and do that part and come back and do Colorado. I just tried to take lower elevation routes and hike along some railroads and do some road walking because I wanted to keep hiking north in a continuous line, but no one likes doing that. I also finished this trail pretty late in the year. This is Glacier National Park, and the big snow had just started to fall. We were within like 60 miles of the border. We were almost there, and it really started coming down. But I was lucky in that it didn't really hinder my hiking at all. It just made it lots more beautiful. And if you do this trail right, you wind up at this little monument that's, I think it's about 8 miles over the border with Canada. And that's my buddy Beaker and I. And if you do all three of those trails, then you get the Triple Crown of Hiking. Quickly comparing the three of the trails, the Appalachian Trail is like high school. It's fun. There's tons of people out there. It's kind of a big moving party. A lot of young people. It's easier. The PCT is more like college. You have to be a little more focused. The crowd's a little bit older, more disciplined. And the Continental Divide Trail is like grad school. The Appalachian Trail is fun. The Pacific Crest Trail is really fun. especially since if you've done another long trail already, you're a little bit lighter, you got your trail legs, you're a little more experienced, so it's really, really fun. The Continental Divide Trail is not fun. It's difficult and rewarding, but it's, friends and family would say, "Hey, are you having fun out there?" And I'd say, "No. It's cold, and I fell in a river, and I'm getting lost every day, and there's no one else out here. I'm going for 7, 8, 10 days in a row without seeing another human." It's a really difficult trail. It's one of those things that it's fun looking back at it. Andrew Skirko once said, and I'm not sure if he invented this, but he talked about the three types of fun. Type one is it's fun when you're doing it and fun to look back on, like Cedar Point. It's fun. Type two is not so much fun when you're doing it, but it's kind of fun to look back on, like basic training. It was no picnic going through it, but looking back, it's all these fond memories. And then type three fun is not fun at all. It's not fun doing it or looking back on it. The Continental Divide Trail is type two fun. It was difficult going through it, but looking back now, it just seemed like the best time of my life. The Appalachian Trail requires hiking big miles over difficult topography every single day. The Pacific Crest Trail requires big miles plus long intervals between water sources and resupply points. So some of the towns on the Pacific Crest Trail are, 140, 150 miles apart. So that means you got to carry, 10, 12 days worth of food. And I know for me, I eat about 1.5 pounds of food a day. So leaving a town to get to the next one, my pack was huge. And it just makes it really, really difficult. It also leads to my favorite activity, which is called eating down your pack weight. So those first couple nights, you eat all you want because you're trying to get your pack lighter. But you really have to balance it out. Otherwise, you'll run out before you get to the next little town. The Continental Divide Trail is big miles, difficult topography, long intervals between food and water, and challenging navigation. That was the hardest part about the Continental Divide Trail was, when I started with these two other guys, we all had paper maps and compass. I had my phone with me. I had GPS in my phone. The other guy had an Android phone with GPS in it, and the third guy had a Garmin GPS with all the data points loaded in there. We still got lost every day. Not terribly lost, but there'd still be that point where we were like, looking, oh no, the trail's actually a mile over that way, and we'd try to get back to it. Just every day it happens. You get used to it. You don't call it lost, you call it misplaced. But at one point, I fell in a river, and my phone got ruined, and so I only had paper map and compass for a few weeks when I was out there, and I'm proud that I did it, but I got lost even more. It's just really difficult. That's me proud to earn with my Burger King paper crown on that I carried all the way from Montana, I think, or from Wyoming, getting my triple crown. I got some other projects coming up. One of them is I was approached by a group of veterans called Warrior Hike, and they've been putting out a team on each of the big trails to hike the trail on behalf of Warrior Hike. They're sponsored the whole way, and they stop in towns along the way and meet with veterans groups and VFW, stuff like that. They want to put a team out late this summer to canoe the entire Mississippi River. It's 2,300 miles from Lake Itasca in Minnesota down to the Gulf of Mexico. And I think I'd like to do that. I think it's a similar aesthetic. I think, you're ultralight, you carry just the bare minimum that you need. And so I'm talking with them. They have a company called Johnson Outdoor who has some sort of a kayak canoe hybrid that they want to promote, and they're going to give us those to try and do it. Another thing I'll show you a map here in a minute is just a pet project called the Michigan Ale Trail. I noticed that when my friends and I go on day hikes, we seem to always wind up at a Michigan brewery. We all love Michigan craft beer, and we all love hiking in Michigan, and those two things just seem to go together. And I noticed too when I did the Great Lake to Lake Trail, there were a lot of trail angels on that. It was sponsored by the Michigan Trails and Greenways Alliance, and a lot of people came out to meet with me and hike with me on the trail. And they'd say, "Hey, can I take you to dinner tonight and everything?" And there's a great Michigan brewery around. We went to Dark Horse, we went to Arcadia, and Witch's Hat, all these great breweries. And so sitting around with my friends, we were like, what if we made a trail that went all the way across Michigan's Lower Peninsula, and you tried to hit a great Michigan brewery like once a day or once every 2 days, like late in the day? And I thought it was a fantastic idea. And so the latest on that is I've been working with the Michigan Trails and Greenways Alliance to map it out. I picked the breweries. That part was easy. But now finding all the little trails that connect them. And Rex Halfpenny, some of you may know that name because he is the godfather of the Michigan craft brewing industry. He's the publisher of the Michigan Beer Guide. He's an amazing guy. And he got in touch with me and said, "Hey, I heard you're working on this thing." And I you know, would love to be able to lend his name to the project. And he said, so write up something, we'll put it in the Michigan Beer Guide and see if we can bring it to fruition. I think I'm the only idiot that would hike the whole thing all the way across, but I think other people might come out and join me for a day or two, or, you know, meet me at one of the breweries. So that's something I'm working on. But the main thing I want to do, the main thing I'm excited about, is the Israeli National Trail. That trail goes 640 miles, I'll come back to that one, 640 miles from the Red Sea all the way up to the border with Lebanon. It's super difficult and exotic, and really few Americans have done it. I learned about it, I was hiking with some young Israeli kids on the Pacific Crest Trail, and two of them had done it before. And they said, in the southern portion in the desert down here, you have to pre-cache your own food and water. You have to go out and bury food and water and mark the GPS coordinates, and then you start at the southern terminus and you hike to each point that you cache your supplies. Super difficult. Hiking all along the Mediterranean Sea, I can't imagine how beautiful that must be. You can take side trips into Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. There's trails that go all through there. So that's something I'm really interested in doing, but lots of planning. Lots of, I mean, round-trip flights to and from Tel Aviv, expensive. It's weird, but half the thing about this trail is just convincing that I'm not doing the trail for any political or religious reasons. I just heard it's a really awesome trail, and I want to do it. But a lot of people, I mentioned to them right away, they're like, oh, it's a dangerous part of the world, or, you know, are you doing it for some religious pilgrimage? And I'm not. I just want to do it because I heard it's really awesome. I'll go back to this crude map that I came out with. These are some of the breweries that we mentioned. We want to start, like, around Saugatuck and probably end up back in Detroit and probably take a zero day or an overnight day in Grand Rapids, because there's so many good breweries there. If you're thinking about hiking, a few things you need to consider. One is, which trail do you want to do? You know, for me, the first real trail was the Appalachian Trail. You know, I had done hiking with the Boy Scouts, and I was in the Army for 6 years. I thought, oh, I did lots of marching, but it turns out marching is different than hiking. But picking a trail and learning about it is one of the most important things. You know, I would say start with a short trail around here. One of my favorites, Jay is tired of me talking about this one, but the Cal Haven Trail goes from Kalamazoo to South Haven. It's like 33 and a half miles. I do it over 3 days. It's nice and flat and easy. There's good water along the way. Anytime someone says to me, hey, I want to try hiking, I take them out on that one because it's a lot of fun and it's easy to do. If you're going to do a big trail, you need to talk about a resupply coordinator. For me, it's traditionally been Martha Rogers and Sandy, though, to some extent. But it's a huge job. It's a bigger job than you think. This is the person that is going to send you resupply boxes to the little towns all along the way, boxes full of food and fuel and maps and bug spray or whatever else that you need. They are your contact with home. They're the one that, you know, if you've been out of touch for 10 days, they're the person that everyone can call and say, where's Chris? Is he okay? Where's he at on the trail? It's a full-time job. You know, you'd like to be able to just map out the hike and say, oh, I'm going to send all my boxes to these, you know, 20 stops, and they'll be there when I get there. But it doesn't work that way. It's kind of a dynamic process, because some towns, maybe you skip a town. Maybe you are going to stop at someone that wasn't on the map. You know, they need to be a person that you can call and say, hey, in a week, I'm going to be in this tiny little town in California that barely has a post office. I need a box to be there, and then take care of you. Time-wise, you know, it took me a ridiculously long 7 months and 9 days to do the Appalachian Trail. That's way longer than it takes most people, but honestly, I just didn't want to come home. I loved it out there, and I wanted to make the experience last as long as possible. The Pacific Crest Trail took 5 months and 25 days. Continental Divide Trail was about 6 months. So, you know, you need to figure out a way to have that kind of time in your life. Money-wise, it cost me about $1 a mile to hike. So when I was gearing up for the Continental Divide Trail, I needed to try and save up, you know, about $3,100. Fell short of that, but somehow still made it. But budget-wise, that's what you're going to need, is about $1 a mile. And that's, I should mention too, that's frugal. That's, you know, skin your teeth kind of hiking. That's not hotel rooms all the time and eating in restaurants all the time. That's stealth camping and staying on the trail. You know, during the entire Continental Divide Trail, I only stayed indoors for 4 nights the whole time. I just tried to keep it, you know, try to keep moving. Gather information, and there's certainly all kinds of books and websites out there. I'll mention a few coming up, but one of my favorites is a Facebook page called the Michigan Hiking and Backpacking page. That was started by my friend Jeff Kindy. He and I were hiking on the Cal Haven Trail, and I was mentioning that I thought it was tough to get in touch with other long-distance hikers in Michigan, and he said, well, start a Facebook page. And so he and I were the first two members. I think we're up to like 1,200 members now, something like that. It's over 1,000. And it's great. It turned into just what we wanted. It's the kind of page where you can go on there and say, hey, I'm thinking about doing the shorter shore. Anyone else done that? And people respond with notes and maps and, hey, there's a trail angel here, or hey, I live near the trail, I could help you. It's really been a great resource. Some of the books that I have up here that I brought, Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods is a hilarious book about the Appalachian Trail. It's been made into a movie, I understand. It was at Sundance. It's Robert Redford stars in that. So great. It's not a technical guide by any means, but it's a common experience. You know, everything from deciding to hike the trail to going out and getting all the gear and, you know, the crazy people that he meets along the way. Really, really exciting read. Earl Schaefer's Walking with Spring. Sorry, these all ran together. Earl Schaefer's Walking with Spring. Again, he's the first guy to hike the Appalachian Trail in 1948. He wrote a book about it, and I read it while I was on the trail, and it was so much fun to see his notes about, you know, any given part, you know, Tennessee or Virginia, and to be at that part. And he just had a very romantic way of writing about the trail. And what a lot of guts, huh? 1948, and he's out there hiking 2,200 miles. Into the Wild with John Krakauer. I mention that because it's going to come up. If you're on the trail, you're going to be sitting on the campfire, and someone's going to say, what about that guy that went up to Alaska and tried to live off the land and died? And everyone has an opinion, and you should read the book to at least be informed about it, whether he was a suicidal maniac or a romantic. You know, a lot of interesting stuff in there. Wild by Cheryl Strayed. So when I was on the Pacific Crest Trail, this book had just come out. Oprah had just named it Book of the Month Club or whatever, and every person I met out there, oh, like that woman in Wild and everything. Not exactly like the woman in Wild, because she only hiked about a third of the trail, I think, and she had, it seemed like a lot of personal issues going on. But that movie with Reese Witherspoon, it's going to be interesting to see if it affects the trail, it affects the number of people going out there. They're already talking about certain resources on the trail perhaps being overwhelmed by the sheer number of hikers that are going to try that trail just because they saw the movie. I hope that it inspires solo females to hike. You know, a lot of women are not comfortable going out there, and I get that, you know, and it's hard to see, you know, from my perspective, but because the trail's a pretty safe place. I mean, the people you meet out there are like-minded people. They're hiking the same as you are. You know, the most dangerous thing is probably hitchhiking. We hitchhike a lot to get in and out of the towns, and I think if you were a female by yourself, that would be inherently risky. But I've known plenty of badass female solo hikers that have way more miles than me. Piper's Flight is a great book about a young lady's adventures on the Pacific Crest Trail. The High Adventures of Eric Rybak, I mentioned that one because, again, he's from Michigan, and he was out doing these long trails in 1977 with blue jeans and big leather boots and a huge external frame pack, and just an amazing guy. And Trail Life, I have a copy of that up here. Again, Ray Jardine is the father of the ultralight hiking movement. Interestingly, his book is the heaviest thing I own. It's like that thick magazine stock paper. It's super heavy. I don't know if Mr. Ultralight did that. Another thing you can do if you're thinking about getting started in hiking is visit Moose Jaw. This is a gear store. The one I go to is in Birmingham, but there's one in Ann Arbor. Great people. I go to Moose Jaw because the people who work in those stores use the stuff they sell. I remember when I first got back from the Appalachian Trail, my buddy said, hey, do you want to go to this gear store up in Birmingham? And I said, a real gear store? Like, you know, canister fuel and ice axes? And he said, oh, yeah. And we went in there, and since then I've had a great relationship with them. They helped me out a lot in return for mentioning their name. The North Country Trail Association is headquartered right near Grand Rapids. And that's the headquarters for the whole 4,600-mile trail. And when I was getting ready to do the Iron Bell Trail, I went to their office, and they provided me with maps and assistance, and they put my name out to some trail angels along the way. Really good folks. So if you're going to do the North Country Trail in any of the 1,150 miles that run through Michigan, you should get in touch with those folks. Pure Michigan has been very good to me. I did a blog for my Great Lake to Lake hike, and since then they've been very supportive, and I met tons of cool people through that blog because they reached so many people. The Burning Boots Trail Club are veterans like myself. They are out of Idaho and Washington, and they have also been super supportive. I just went out and visited them. They brought me out last month to give a talk to the veterans and do some hiking with them. Really good people. The Good Shepherd United Methodist Church in Dearborn, good good folks, have always been really supportive of my hiking. Or if you're thinking about hiking, get in touch with me. If I can't be hiking, the next best thing for me is to talk about hiking. So you are welcome to call me. You can visit my website, Hillier Hikes. I blog here, and of course I have tons of Facebook friends and stuff like that. At this point, I will say in advance, thank you all for coming out. Thank you so much. Thank you so much to the Pittsfield branch of the Ann Arbor Library for hosting me, and I would love to hear if you have any questions.
If you have any questions, raise your hand. I'll come on over with the mic.
Someone's got a question. There we go.
Just a moment. Would you wait till I can get you? Get you? Sorry.
I'm going to hike half the AT, 1,100 miles. I'm going to go Springer Mountain to Harper's Ferry and then the last 100-mile wilderness in Maine.
Yes.
I'm going to try to leapfrog up there.
Yes.
You mentioned that it's just a big moving party. Will there be portions where I'm just off my own? I don't see another human for a couple
Not
days?
Not initially. When you start from Springer Mountain, the shelters are crowded. The campsites are crowded. You'll see people, you know, every hour. There'll be a lot of people. Tons of people drop off within the first, like, 10 days. By the time you get to Neal's Gap, I think, like, you know, 40% of the hikers had quit. Oh. Interestingly, you know, when they ask hikers, you know, why did you quit? For the Pacific Crest Trail, most people quit because they get injured. They get soft tissue injuries. Most people quit the Appalachian Trail because they say, it's not what I thought it was going to be. Which begs the question, what do you think is? It's rocks and trees and hills and bugs. That's what it is. So initially, there'll be tons of people. But by the time you get to Virginia, the crowds will thin out a little bit. You'll have ditched all the wannabes and pack sniffers. And it'll be more hardcore hikers. And when you get to Harper's Ferry, that's a really cool little town. Obviously, tons of Civil War history, but very hiker-friendly. And I did similar to what you're planning in that I hiked from Springer Mountain to Harper's Ferry, and then we took a train up to Katahdin and then came back to Harper's Ferry. So flip-flop it, we call. And for me, that made all the sense in the world because, number one, it relieved all the pressure of the weather. We didn't have to race, you know, the winter. And number two, it was easier for friends and family to get to Harper's Ferry than Mount Katahdin, which is super remote Maine. And one more quick thing about that 100 miles wilderness. It's 100 miles with nothing out there, not even a fire road. So bring enough food. I was told initially to bring 10 days worth of food. And then some more experienced hikers said, you don't need 10, 7 days will be fine. So I said, okay, so I packed 7 days worth of food. But the train ride to get up to Katahdin took like 2 whole days. And I ate like 2 days worth of food doing that. So I ran out of food. And I lived off blueberries for about 2 days, and it was a tough situation. I mean, you just get super lethargic. You know, it gets really hard to keep going. And by the time I got into the little town at the end of the 100 miles wilderness, I remember I came into this little hiker hostel, and they had a little restaurant there, and the woman says, are you doing okay? You know, and I said, I'm really hungry. I haven't eaten in 2 days. And she calls back to the kitchen. She says, we need an emergency plate of fries. And the guy comes out, and I just... dug into them big time, so manage your food accordingly.
I have one more question.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that you brought a book to read. Mm-hmm. Do you send yourself books in your resupply boxes?
Or my coordinator sends me books.
Right.
Yes, and that is not very ultralight of me. But I like to read to fall asleep. And I read everything out there. You know, it's a chance to read the classics again and you know, all kinds of stuff. And it's nice, but... it's if you're willing to bear the weight. I would do small paperbacks. Don't try and bring a hardcover book or anything like that because you'll see when you get out there that light is fast and fast is fun.
I have two questions.
Yes.
First one is what's your pack weight now that you're, what's your goal pack weight?
Right. A lot of hikers will talk about their base pack weight is what we say. And that's how much does all your gear weigh minus food and water. So right now I'm running at about 18 pounds or so, which is not ultralight. You know, some of these guys have base pack weights of 8 and 10 pounds. But for me, I like a few indulgences. I like a tent. I like a paperback book. You know, I bring a couple extra things. But then when you add on, you know, water weighs, you know, 2.2 pounds per liter food, like I said, I eat about a pound and a half a day. So coming out of a town with full food and water, you know, can be upwards of 30 pounds. It can be really heavy. So, I constantly reevaluate my gear and try to see where can I cut corners? Is there something that can serve two purposes that I can get rid of something? Or is there a new product that's lighter made of some other material? It's a constant process. It's evolution. Your second question.
My second question is what was going through my mind, especially on the Continental Divide, is what was, when were you, did you feel the most frightened, threatened, or your, just your fright, most scary experience?
There are a lot of days, a lot of times. And one thing I like to do is, you know, really think logically about the difference between, you know, possibility and probability. You know, is it possible you could get attacked by a bear? Yeah, there's grizzly bears out there. Is it probable? No. Look at the statistics. You know, is it likely to happen? And if it's not likely to happen, I try not to worry about it too much. But there were a few scenarios. For example, one was I was by myself, and there was a snow bridge that went kind of across a river. It was the side of a mountain, and the river's coming down, and the snow bridge went across it. And, you know, the water ran under it, and it was, I mean, really fast-moving white water with huge rocks. It was probably about 8 feet down. And no one had gone on it before me. There were no foot tracks. And I looked to the side to see kind of how thick it was. You know, I was like about that. And I thought, will that support my weight? You know, I am afraid to cross this bridge. Now, you know, is it possible that I could fall through? Certainly. Is it probable? Not sure. And so it was a scary thing. And it's either cross that bridge or go back, you know, 36 miles to the last little town. So I took off my pack and I tied my paracord on it, and I ran across real quick, and then I pulled my pack across, and I made it across. But stuff like that was happening, it seemed like every day I was out there thinking, like, this is mountaineering. I'm a long-distance hiker. What am I? I got the ice axe and the crampons. I'm about to fall off this mountain. Well, this is way beyond my skill level. How did I get here? But, you know, you just be careful and take it step by step, and it works out. Lots of fear on that trail.
I think you partially answered the question that I want to ask. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you spent a great deal of time without any contact with other human beings.
Yes, sir.
So besides thinking about the probabilities and these different scenarios, mm-hmm. how are you keeping your mind active? What are you thinking about?
Right.
Spending all of that time by yourself?
It's a good question. And let me address first the solitude, which is an issue out there. You know, I think by nature I'm kind of a loner, you know, but... people told me, people who had done the Continental Divide Trail said, get ready for serious, you know, seclusion. And when I did the Short of Short Trail, I spent, I think, about 3 days without seeing another person. And it bothers you. You start getting weird. You start thinking the whole world got nuked and no one told you, you know. And when you finally do run into another person, you're like, hey, how you doing? You want to tell me, you know, you talk tons. And so I knew that was going to be an issue in the Continental Divide Trail. And it was. There were long stretches without seeing another person. What do I think about most of the time? My sister-in-law asked me this question, and I pondered it carefully, and the answer is breathing. I think about my breathing and my pace most of the time. I try to go fast enough so I'm not mouth breathing, just fast enough so I'm breathing heavily through my nose. So pace and breathing most of the time. Other than that, song lyrics and high school and whatever. You know, the beautiful thing about it is, as you go through your daily life, all these things happen, and some of them, you know, maybe big issues or traumatic to some extent, and you don't have time to think about it. You compartmentalize it, you put it away, I'll think about it later, and you never do. When you're out there for months and months, you have time to reflect thoroughly on all those things, and you think about it and turn it over in your mind until you really are done with it. And a lot of issues tend to, you know, I mentioned doing the Appalachian Trail, my mother just passed away, and all that went down and how my family reacted to it. There was a lot to think about, and I felt like I really had the chance to do some serious soul-searching and think about all those things and put them to rest. So, but the main thing I think about, breathing and pace. Next question.
You mentioned that you took a pound and a half of food per day. Mm-hmm. How many calories and what was it that you were eating?
So hikers look at calorie to weight ratios a lot. What foods give you the most bang for your buck? And it turns out olive oil is tons of calories for a little bit of weight. Peanut M&Ms, certain weird things like that will give you a lot of calories. Let me mention nutrition overall. First of all, I have a terrible habit of getting dangerously thin out on the trails, and then I come back and I put on some town pounds, you know, and I get a little heavier, and then when I go back on the trail, I lose all that weight again, and that's not good. A guy like Scott Williamson, the guy who does the Pacific Crest Trail, he walks around at 165 pounds. He starts at a trail at 165, and he finishes at 165. He's got his nutrition dialed in. He knows what he likes to eat. He knows to get the right amount and right kinds of calories to do that sort of hiking. For me, I eat, everything's lightweight. Lots of minute rice, lots of ramen noodles, everything's dehydrated, lots of beef jerky. You know, some things I'll splurge on, like Pop-Tarts, you know, peanut M&Ms, stuff like that. The truth is, when I'm out there on the trail, I'm an opportunistic omnivore. I eat whatever comes my way or whatever I have a chance at. And, you know, it's true. Hunger's the best spice. You're so famished out there that anything, you know, someone offers you or that you get a chance to eat, you'll dive right at it. But the key is, for the things that you're carrying, calorie-to-weight ratio and, you know, how light it is. More questions?
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Have you ever sustained an injury of any kind, and how do you deal with that on the trail?
Yeah, it's a risk. You know, you're out there and no one's around, and I've been pretty lucky. I fell on the Appalachian Trail, and a root was sticking up and hit me in the ribs, and I think I broke a rib because it hurt for days afterward, and it kind of clicked when I was breathing in and out, but, you know, what can you do? Everyone gets, you know, usually you'll get a little GI upset at some point or another, especially if you're not careful about filtering your water. Everyone gets that. You know, you get beat up, you get nicked up and bruised, and certainly your feet take a beating. It's strange that you're building your body up in one way, especially endurance-wise and cardiovascular-wise, and you're beating your body down in another way with all the poison ivy and the burn that you got on your hand. You cut yourself over here, and you half twisted your ankle over here. So it's a strange thing, but a definite risk. You know, you just try not to do anything, try not to take risks that will get you hurt and take you off the trail.
Two questions, please. One of them you mentioned about feet, and I was curious to know, how do you deal with preventing things like blisters, for example?
Yeah.
And the other question, if I may, is, besides water, do you take any packets of anything to put in the water or just drink water?
I do. I'll talk about the foot issue first. You know, every long-distance hiker has blisters. Even if you're really experienced, you're going to have terrible blisters, and it's just it's a matter of fact of life on the trail. Eventually, they turn into calluses. And, you know, it doesn't hurt so bad. Another strange thing that happens to your feet on these trails is they get wider and flatter. I went up almost a size and a half on the Appalachian Trail, from like a 10 to an 11 and a half. And then my foot kind of got back into its normal shape. And then when I did the Pacific Crest Trail, same thing happened, but a little bit sooner. And then on the Continental Divide Trail, it happened like within a couple weeks. My feet went up, got flat and went up like a whole size. And the trail running shoes I had to start with were already like a little bit snug. And I just split the sides of them. They just opened right up. Not to gross you out, but toenails fall off, huge flaps of skin. It's very hard on your feet. But eventually, you know, they get tough, they build up, and you get calluses, and it's not so bad. But those first few weeks of any long-distance hike are tough. And the second question regarding flavoring your water, absolutely. I splurge on a little drink mix, a little Crystal Light packet or whatever, any of those, because some of the water sources are heinous. I mean, it's like, you know, on the Continental Divide Trail, like, a puddle full of cow poop, basically. And so you scoop up a bottle of it, and you filter it through a bandana to get all the big stuff out, and then you put it through your filter to get all the, you know, small stuff out, but you're still left with nasty, warm, brown water. So I add, you know, a packet of something or whatever just to make it, just to be able to choke it down. But, yeah, it's nasty, but you're glad for it. If it's been 30 miles since your last water, you're glad for it. Other questions?
So I'm interested in wildlife. Your encounters, good or bad, or, you know, scary things, the snakes or bears or whatever.
Yeah, the three most dangerous things, animals that you can run into on a trail, most people say. Number one is another human. I mean, even though they're all like-minded people, they're the most capable of hurting you, you know, and if someone had ill intent, they could really do some damage. The second one is a skunk. If you get sprayed by a skunk, you're in trouble because you're not going to be able to get. No one's going to let you stay in a hotel room, or whatever. It can be bad. And I've had skunks in the. They call it the vestibule of my tent. You know, it's like a little area in there. And I had a skunk in there, and I was just like, because I can't run, and I did not want to upset that thing. So they're scary. And then the third thing is bear cubs, because if there's bear cubs around, then sometimes there's adult bears around, and they get a little excited. Bears is a whole another issue. You know, I've seen. On all the trails I've done, maybe a dozen or 14 bears along the way, had one encounter that was my own fault. I'll tell you the story real quick, but don't tell anyone else. And here's why. Along the Continental Divide Trail, everyone said, are you carrying bear spray? And bear spray, real bear spray, is a big canister. It's like a small fire extinguisher. And I said, no, I'm not carrying bear spray because, again, possibilities and probabilities. Is it probable that I'm going to get attacked by a bear? No. Read the stats. It really hardly ever happens. But I started getting nervous because other long-distance hikers, guys, you know, who were otherwise ultralight, were spending the weight, so to speak, on that bear spray. And so, especially on the blog, I was shooting my mouth off, I'm not carrying bear spray. And a lot of people were like, you should. And I said, I'm not going to. And so I did make it the entire hike without needing bear spray the whole time. Saw a bunch of bears, but they all just ran away as soon as I saw them. After the hike, I was camping for about a week or so, I think, in the tiny town of East Glacier, Montana, waiting for a train trip to come back home. And I had this sweet campsite. It was right outside town, right near a river, no one around for miles. It was just beautiful. But there was a black bear in the area. And the first day he came to my tent, I was sleeping. I was reading a little paperback book, and I fell asleep. And I woke up and heard, like, I thought there was someone standing outside my tent and heard, like, the breathing, the heavy breathing. And my tent wasn't zipped. I stuck my face out, and he was right there, like, snout to snout. And it scared me. And I yelled, you know, hey, and he took off running. So what you're supposed to do at that point is move. If you've been bared, then you have to leave. You have to go find another spot. But this was a really sweet spot. So I stayed there, and he kept coming around. About every day or every other day, I would see him come around. And, you know, again, looking back, I should have just moved. I tried to tell myself that, all right, I know this is a black bear's territory, and I know that they're fairly skittish compared to grizzlies, and there's also grizzlies up there. I don't want to move out of a black bear territory into a grizzly territory, so I'll just stay here. But I'll also be honest, I wasn't being careful with my food and my trash. You know, I'd been staying in this one spot for a week, and I was getting sloppy. With that. So I was in the town and talking to some other hikers and explained my situation that this bear kept coming around. And a buddy of mine says, well, I'm done with my hike. Do you want to borrow my bear spray? And I said, okay, but don't tell anyone because I've been shooting my mouth off. So he handed it to me and I kind of tucked it. And I went back to my tent. And the next day, sure enough, he started coming from my tent. And so I thought, okay, here's my chance. And I grabbed the bear spray. And the first thing I noticed when I really looked at it is the label was, like, completely worn off. I don't know how old this stuff was. I thought, it better work. This guy is coming right for my tent. And so I kind of leaned out, and I got it ready. And when he got within about 8 feet, I hit it, and it sprays out orange. I didn't know that, but it went out, and he took off running. So it worked. A little bit of it blew back toward me. There was a little bit of a breeze, and, man, that's, I mean, just every, you can really feel it. You know, I shouldn't have done that for a couple reasons. Number one, it's unethical. I nearly lured him to my tent by leaving, you know, food and trash out. Number two, bear spray is intended to be used if you're being attacked by a bear. He wasn't attacking me. He was just coming to smell around my tent. It was more about me sort of defending, you know, my territory. But I can tell you how people that live up there in East Glacier, how they deal with a bear, they just put him down without even thinking about it. So, you know, at least I didn't do that. But so yeah, bears are an issue on all these trails. There's new regulations in place. And when the year I did the Pacific Crest Trail, you are required by federal law to carry a bear canister for certain parts of it. A bear canister is a plastic cylinder. You screw the top off, and you put all your food and anything that, you know, toiletries, anything that has an odor to it, you put it all in there, and then you screw on the top. And I didn't carry one because, well, a couple reasons. One is they're expensive. Number two is they're heavy. And you know, number three, I think I read a study that said, like, less than 10% of hikers use those bear cans the way they're intended to be used, you know, putting all their stuff in there. Most people sit on them or put water and a little soap in there and wash their clothes. You know, it's no one uses them the way they're supposed to. I also heard new last year's a portion of the Appalachian Trail through the Great Smoky Mountains requires bear can. So you'll have to look into that regulation. Federal law. So, other questions? I can tell you the number one question I usually get asked that I didn't get asked tonight is, do you carry a gun? Everyone asks that for some reason. And the answer is no, I don't carry a gun. I mean, first of all, you're not likely to need it. Second of all, how much does a handgun weigh? I mean, it's a couple of pounds, I think, plus the ammo. It's, you know, the Appalachian Trail goes through 14 different states, so there's no way it would be legal, I don't think, in all those states. And, you know, there's nothing out there to hurt you. There really just isn't. No, I don't carry a gun, but that is usually the number one question that I get asked.
Well, let's spark some more questions.
All right.
What kind of stove do you use?
Oh, I just have this little screw-on. It's kind of a similar to an MSR pocket rocket, and it just screws onto a fuel canister. It's a propane butane mix, isopro it's called, and you just screw it on there and spark it up, and that can boil a liter of water in less than 4 minutes. So nice and hot, legal in California. In California, you can't do campfires. They don't like alcohol stoves. You're not supposed to do anything except canister fuel. And even to use this, you have to have a permit. But yeah, it's super lightweight, reliable, easy to use. This is just a knockoff version. I don't even know who makes this one, but one of the most common ones is it's called Pocket Rocket. It's by MSR. Yes, ma'am.
I just saw that everyone has a trail name, and I was wondering what your trail name is.
Yeah, that's a good question. My trail name is Wolverine, is what people call me. And when I first started the Appalachian Trail, I heard about trail names, and I thought, I'm not going to participate in that. Nicknames are silly, you know. But number one, it's unavoidable. Once you get a trail name, it sticks, and that's what you will be known as. Number two, it's not so much about a nickname as it is about forgetting who you are back in the towns. No one cares. It's about who you are out here. So whether you're a judge or a criminal back in Michigan, it doesn't matter. So about 3 days into the Appalachian Trail, I was hiking along with this kid, and he came running up, and he said, Chris, I got a trail name for you. And I said, what is it? Because not everyone likes their trail name. And so I said, what is it? And he said, Wolverine. And I said, why Wolverine? He said, well, because you're from Michigan, which in Georgia was kind of a novelty. And he said, because you're tenacious. And I said, clearly you don't know me very well. He said, no. He said, last night when we all stopped at the shelter, you kept on going. I said, I only went like another quarter mile, and it was just so I didn't have to listen to you guys snoring in the shelter all night. So I don't call it tenacious, but it stuck, and it's just how it is. So those of you who hit these trails will wind up, something will happen to you or something about you, and you'll get a trail name. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Considering that you're racing against winter when you go on these long hikes, is there a reason why you go south to north instead of north to south?
Yeah, it depends on the trail. Some of them, it just seems more natural, or the trail is just more sort of designed that way, like the Appalachian Trail. Just the stops and the way things are, it just seems more natural to go south to north, or NOBO, N-O-B-O, northbound, we call it. Other trails, like the Pacific Crest Trail and especially the Continental Divide Trail, it's a crapshoot. The Continental Divide Trail, if you start in the south, as you head north, you might hit deep snow in the South San Juan Mountains, like I did. It's just, it's one of the risks. If you start in the north and head south, you could hit deep snow in Glacier National Park. So either way, you're just betting that, you're hoping that you'll have a good weather year, or just dealing with it when it comes. But you want to start as early in the year as you can, but not so that it's still, too cold out, and finish as soon as you can. Again, that Pacific Crest Trail, I hiked it as fast as I could, but it's 2,600 miles, and it took me every bit of 5 months and 25 days. Sir.
I noticed you have two packs behind you. Why?
Because I'm a gear junkie, and it builds up after a while. This was the pack that I did the Appalachian Trail with, and people that I hiked with all signed it, so it has a lot of sentimental value to me. But where I'm at now with hiking, it's too heavy, probably. Dakota. It's a, forget the brand. This pack is a little bit more lightweight. This is a Granite Gear AC60. Real good, just minimalist pack. I carried that for the entire Pacific Crest Trail, and it did great. And it's pretty much my go-to pack for now. And then the pack that I did the Continental Divide Trail with was that pack that company made for me, and I had to send it back for them. They wanted to tear it apart. And I was told they're putting it into production this spring. They're going to call it the Divide. So I was kind of happy about that. Other questions for me?
You mentioned that you changed the types of shoes you were wearing on the Pacific Crest Trail from boots to shoes.
Right.
What was that, and what kind did you use?
The trend for a long time was heavy, like these over-the-ankle boots, Gore-Tex lined, the thinking being, keep your feet, as dry as possible for as long as possible and have enough support in the ankle. But I think that trend has shifted now. Way more people are doing trail shoes or trail running shoes. The advantage of those is, number one, they're lighter. It's been said that for every pound on your feet, it's like having 10 pounds on your back. So you want something light on your feet. The second thing is, these are less likely to get wet. But when they do get wet, when they get really soaked, they stay wet for days. They take forever to dry out. Gore-Tex just holds that water, around your foot. Whereas trail running shoes dry out a lot quicker. The thinking is you'll get wet more often, but they'll dry out a lot quicker. So especially for desert hiking, the beginning of the Continental Divide Trail, I wore Montrail Fluid Flex, compliments of Running Fit here in Ann Arbor, great people there. And they were good. You get probably less miles out of them overall. I think a good pair of trail running shoes probably last you 500 to 700 miles, whereas a good pair of sturdy boots I can get, you know, 1,200 to 1,500 miles out of. So it depends on where you're hiking, you know, how often your feet are going to get soaked, how light you want to be. You have to compare all those things. So I can tell you my next pair of shoes is going to be from Omos Footwear. They're coming out with some really innovative designs. They have a new shoe called the Sundog, which is super lightweight, dries real quick. That'll be my next trail shoe. Oboes. Yep. OBOZ.
You mentioned that you felt safe while you're hiking, and that the threat from some animals. Did you ever run across a human who you thought this person could be some really serious danger?
Right. Good question. I definitely feel more safe on the trail than in downriver Detroit, where I live. That's for sure. There was one guy along the Appalachian Trail who said he had a hiker hostel, and he was really anxious to get my friend and I to come and stay in his hostel. And we stopped at a ranger station to call him to make arrangements. And the rangers there said, you know, he's had some complaints. I guess he, you know, gets pretty wild at night. And more than a few hikers have left in the middle of the night and come here and said this guy was dangerous. And so I said, all right, well, thanks for the advice. So I called the guy back and I said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. It turns out we're not going to do it. And he was adamant that I'd come and stay at his hostel. And he even drove to the ranger station. And he was like, are they bad-mouthing me in there and everything? And it was a whole weird thing. So I had to forcefully tell him, you know, thank you, but no thank you. He tried to grab my pack and put it in his car, and I was like, knock it off. But that encounter is outweighed by the hundreds of super nice people that I've met that have gone way out of their way and just been super, super generous and, you know, really really added to my hiking experience. Way more trail angels than guys like that idiot. Good question.
I'll be right back.
Just quickly, synthetic or down?
Down, yeah. I use a Marmot helium sleeping bag, and I just think if you can maintain the loft, it keeps you warmer, it dries pretty quick, so down for me. But a good question. Everyone goes back and forth on that.
You mentioned you had a phone, so I'm wondering how you charged your phone. Mm-hmm. And did you keep any kind of a journal?
I'll answer both those by saying a smartphone is an indispensable piece of equipment for a hiker today. It seems weird, but it's your journal, it's your voice recordings, it's your contact with the outside world, it's your camera, it's your GPS, it's your flashlight in a pinch, it's, you know, your entertainment, you know, so you need it for all those things. Battery power is an absolute issue. I only use my phone, especially on the Continental Divide Trail, as little as I had to. You know, I would do paper, map, and compass, and when I was really off course, I'd fire up the phone and you know, use the GPS to figure out where I was and then turn it back off, you know, and or you know, if I thought I was going to use it a lot, just try to keep it on airplane mode because battery power is that precious. A lot of guys carry a spare battery, a backup battery, but that adds to the weight. So when you get into a town, you charge up your phone and your backup battery if you have one, and it's a not uncommon sight to go into a McDonald's that's near a major trail and see four or five hikers with the multi-outlet and everyone's plugged in and they're all charging and they're all trying to keep up, you know, with friends and family and updating Facebook and all that stuff. When my phone got wet, I really, you know, I felt it. So if I was going to do the Continental Divide Trail again, I would get an iPhone 6 and a LifeProof, I think it's the company, a LifeProof case and a big backup battery. That's how important it is. And that's how I do my journaling. I do. Gearwise, my choice would be an iPhone 6 with a LifeProof case and a big backup battery, a 2000 mAh or whatever backup battery. It would be worth the wait. It's so important out there. So, good question.
Another question occurred to me. Training. How does the novice train for a first hike, and how do you train?
It's a good question. A lot of people say you can either get in shape for the trail or the trail will get you in shape. And I chose the latter, especially when I first started the Appalachian Trail. I was heavier, and it's tough. Those first couple weeks, you know, getting your trail legs under you, It's really difficult, and I was just sucking for air. It felt like a lot of the day, but the weight just falls off. You know, you burn like 7,000 to 10,000 calories a day out there. You can't possibly carry enough food to, you know, keep up with that. So you lose a lot of weight right away, and your cardiovascular system gets in shape. So, you know, when I was in the Army, the drill sergeant said, if you want to be able to do a lot of push-ups, do push-ups. So I say, if you want to get in shape to do hike. Go out as often as you can. Grab a bottle of water and go hike. Other questions for me?
So mine is about sticking to an itinerary. Mm-hmm. I've sort of drawn up how many miles I want to do a day, and I'm just wondering how difficult you think it is to meet your deadlines day by day, or you talked about it at the very beginning, just making the hiking your own. Do you sort of just...
Yeah, I think especially on the Appalachian Trail, one common mistake people do is they try to do too many miles too quick. You know, they read a lot about, oh, I was doing 20 miles a day, and they get out there and try and do it, and they get injured or they get, you know, just dissatisfied with the experience. Some good advice I got, and I followed it, was for the first week on the AT, keep your mileage below 12 miles a day. Like the first day, I just did like 8 miles, and I was like, I'm sure I can do more. I feel great, but just taking this advice, I kept it really short the first few days, and I was so glad I did that. It gave my body a chance to break in. Itineraries are exceedingly difficult to stick to. I mean, sometimes I see people like, I'm going to be at this place on this day, and I'm going to stop at this, and it never works out because, you know, days take longer or shorter, or you, didn't feel well that day, so you couldn't do that many miles, but you hiked with these other guys who were faster than you on this other day, so you did a ton of miles, and so it's really hard to stick to. That's why I'm saying it would be nice to just pre-mail yourself all the boxes you need and the dates that you're going to be there, but it's more of a dynamic process. It's hard too. I'll try to mention to meet someone on the trail, like hiking through Massachusetts. My sister lives there. I was like, hey, come on, meet me on the trail. And she's like, great. When are you going to be there? And I was like, September. It's really hard to pin down a day and a time when you're going to be. The best thing is just to keep in constant communication. And as you get close to a place, then you're able to set up the date and time. You, when you're out there, you forget the time, the day. You don't even know what month it is sometimes. You know, you are so disconnected from society. And for me, I thought that was going to be an issue. I was kind of a news junkie. I was always watching news channels, or I had a crawler on my laptop, you know, the news all the time. And then you get out there, and I thought, man, I'm not going to know what's going on in the world. It turns out it doesn't matter. You don't need it. All you need to know is where the next water source is and, you know, where you're going to camp that night. I remember coming into a little bait and tackle shop on the Appalachian Trail, and they had a TV up in the corner, and the newscast was about Osama bin Laden, them getting Osama bin Laden. I said, they got Osama bin Laden? The guy was like, yeah, like a month ago. where have you been? I was like, in the woods, you know. So you think you need all that stuff, but you don't. You just need to know where the next water source is. Other questions for me? They're making you run.
I don't know how many miles am I going to log on this night, right? Breaking my trail legs in.
Long distance host.
This is a little more personal. Do you carry things like packets of moist towelettes, and how do you manage toilet paper?
Ah, good question. I do carry those. So my routine, without getting too graphic, is I go 50 paces, 70 feet off the trail. I don't go near the sight or sound of water at all. And then I dig a cat hole. I have a little plastic trowel. You dig a cat hole 4 to 6 inches deep, take care of business. You do use toilet paper. That goes in the cat hole. That all gets buried. And then I use a moist towelette to clean my hands afterward, and I pack that out. So, yes, I carry all that stuff. And I also use moist towelettes for foot care. Give some love to your feet in the evening. So, yeah, they're useful.
If there's no further questions, please join me in thanking Chris for all this great information.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks to Chris Field and Ann Arbor Library. Thanks, everyone. I'm going to be hanging around. I got some gear and some books if you guys want to come up and look at stuff.